So the two themes for the retreat, the general categories for the themes, are the qualities that are cultivated in practice and the things that we have insight about. So these two sides of practice, side of cultivation and the side of insight. And insight is generally understood to be things that are revealed as we cultivate and develop ourselves in practice, and practice unfolds, then in its own time, there are insights. There are things that stand out, powers of observation really see something very clearly. And when certain insights are had with enough clarity, they help us to shift our understanding of the world, our understanding of ourselves, in such a way that we become freer, freer with the world, freer with ourselves. Sometimes when Buddhism is taught, emphasis is given on the insights, so much so that they become kind of, rather than insights, they become ideas, wisdom ideas, wise ideas, that people then carry with them and apply to their life. And sometimes that's very useful, but sometimes applying understanding to our life masks or covers over the capacity to have insight, to see directly. So the three characteristics are the key insight of the Vipassana tradition. And so the insight into impermanence, the insight into suffering, and the insight into not-self. And we'll talk about those in the last 3 days of the retreat. But sometimes those are considered kind of wisdom teachings as well, and people find it useful to understand, yes, things are impermanent, and it's no surprise that some things happen. Your car gets a flat tire, and you realize, yeah, all things are impermanent. This shouldn't be too much of a surprise that this should happen. But sometimes the overlaying impermanence or suffering, the understanding on top of our life, precludes the possibility of insight, because insight requires us to have a very clear seeing, unmediated by carrying with us a lot of ideas. So we can't, you know, the idea is not to have ideas, concepts that we carry with us. So unfortunately, even Buddhist teachings sometimes get in the way of real insight, because we have this understanding we carry with us, we're applying, we're trying to understand things by. And the possibility in a retreat is to let go of a lot of the common understandings we have so that we can see in a fresh way. So those are the three insights. But those insights occur on a foundation of qualities we cultivate. And so part of the function of retreat is to cultivate qualities, cultivate ourselves. And we're not trying to cultivate more impermanence. There's enough of it. And we're not trying to cultivate more suffering. That would be, what's the point? And we're not trying to cultivate maybe we're cultivating not self, but that's the people trying to cultivate not self are usually irritating to everyone else. But rather what we're cultivating can be seen as being the opposite of the three characteristics, three insights, and important part of practice is to cultivate stability, which is can be seen as the opposite of impermanence. The opposite of suffering is, I like to call it, well-being. And so we're trying to cultivate a certain modicum, a certain degree of well-being, because well-being supports our ability to see clearly. And so even to be able to see suffering clearly, some kind of well-being is helpful. And then in order to be able to see, have insight into this thing called not-self, it helps to have what's in the West can be called a strong sense of self. Though Buddhists, as I said last night, Buddhists are kind of reluctant to use that language of self to describe the opposite of not-self, because as soon as you use the language of self, it becomes a magnet for all kinds of ideas of what it means to be a self. Associations we have with it, and it gets very complicated very quickly. And to save us from those complications, Buddhism focuses on particular qualities, not the category of self. So we would develop qualities of confidence, qualities of inner strength, qualities of integrity. There's a lot of personal qualities that are developed through practice, and when those become strong, then we could conventionally say a strong sense of self. But those strong qualities are the opposite of the foundation or the for being able to see the not self teaching. The kind of what I like to represent this quality that's the opposite of not self is confidence. Sometimes it takes a form of courage. So the first three talks of the retreat will be these three qualities that are cultivated, three categories of qualities, and then the last three talks will be the three insights that come out of, based on those three foundations. And I think that if you understand how the three qualities that are cultivated are the foundation for the three insights, then the insights make more sense, and the insights are supported by something, because to simply be told that everything's impermanent when one's life is completely unstable anyway, and that's why everything is not working, it doesn't help people. Actually, some people just makes things harder. And to tell someone who is has a very fragmented and disorganized sense of self that there is not, that there's no self, could just leave them more fragmented and kind of without any foundation. So these three qualities to be cultivated. For today, the topic is stability. And so there are other words that could be useful, concepts, something like steadiness, stillness, a variety of ways. Another word is a constancy. Another word that's kind of related to this family is regularity. So to have some sense of this, there's a regularity of commitment, regularity of practice, regularity of engagement, that there's constancy in our efforts, constantly in our practice, that there is stability in certain things that we can count on. So for example, as I think is well known, it's very helpful for children to grow up in stable environments, a stable relationship to a parent or parents, a stable relationship, to home life. And when there's lack of stability, there's a variety of ways which then people grow up with somewhat challenged, easily become afraid, easily become angry, easily rebel, easily a whole bunch of kind of ways that people then start to responding to the world, because internally there's no sense of stability. But with children who grew up with stability in their family, they internalize a certain kind of stability. So that when they become adults and they enter into a much more unstable world, they carry that inner stability with them. And so they're not kind of pushed around or by the changing natures of what life will often bring. So the same thing with societies. Societies that are unstable make it very difficult for the members of society to function well. And people become afraid, they get angry, tends to be much more violence in unstable societies. That instability of a society as a whole sometimes gets translated or passed down into subsections of the society. Even within families, things get much more challenging. One of the ideals is to have a stable society, so that human beings can feel safe, human beings can feel that the best qualities and the best interests they have can come forth and they can act on those rather than just struggling to get by, struggling for security. That can happen in so many places in the world, even here in the United States. I like to think that kind of one of the kind of little slogans for the American ideal of social stability is the town motto, at Barre, Massachusetts. Barre, Massachusetts is the place where the first Insight Meditation Retreat Center like ours was established in 1976. And when they went to look at the seminary they were going to buy for the retreat center, IMS. They looked at it, and then they went into the little town of Barrie nearby. In the little town square, they saw a plaque or something that had the town motto. And it said, "Tranquil and alert." And they said, "Ah, this is the place for us." So personally, also, it helps to have some stability. People who are unstable with, you know, housing, work, relationship, often find themselves kind of at loose ends, or find challenged and agitated, restless, and in a variety of ways. And it's hard for the mind then to settle down and feel, you know, get focused on the task at hand. So at a retreat center like this, we attempt, within reason, to offer some degree of stability for the week that you're here. There's regular meals that mostly you can count on. So far, they've showed up. They've been there when we went down for them. The schedule is a regular schedule, which offers some stability and reference point for us. You don't have to wonder and question, what am I going to do now? There's not a lot of choices to be made here, because you look at the schedule and the choice has been made for you. Now you go sit. Now you don't have to go out to every sitting, but you know there's a choice made, and you don't have to be questioning and wondering a lot. What are all the choices? Go home, and you have to choose, you know, which website are you going to spend time on? And there's a few of them to choose from, so you know, it can feel a little bit difficult. And there's a certain kind of stability that comes when there's no websites to choose from. You know, just a schedule. You know, just go to sit and walk and sit and walk, and then a meal. And then you don't have to decide what you're going to eat. With it, you know, maybe you choose a little bit between the things that are being offered, but the choices are not that great. And so there's an stability, regularity that provides. It's a quiet place. Some of the instability that happens when we talk is not so, it doesn't happen so readily here, because it's mostly kept in silence while we're here. I'm sure that if we spent a week talking instead of a week in silence, we would get to know each other in different ways. Some of you maybe would have nice, deep conversations. And some of you would, you know, it'd be more challenging to work and live together. And so the social world kind of stirs things up. Somehow the quiet being together with a shared purpose, a shared commitment, creates a certain stability, allows something hopefully to relax and to settle. One of the aims of meditation is to create a stable mind. Some of you, as meditators the world over discover, will have at times monkey mind. A monkey mind is a mind which is not stable. A monkey mind is one that's constantly moving. So they say that a monkey mind is the analogy of the monkey that is swinging from tree to tree, and just before it grabs one tree, it's already reaching the other, letting go and reaching forward for the next branch to grab. And so just constant grabbing, going forward, forward. And so sometimes the mind is restless, agitated, caught up in its thoughts, and just grabbing one thought after the other. So it's hard to settle down. And so what we're looking for to cultivate on retreat is inner stability. So that comes with a quieter mind, a settled mind, a concentrated mind. We're looking for a mind and a body which is not agitated or restless. So that's supported by hopefully getting enough sleep, hopefully getting enough, getting our needs met, get the right amount of food, and having the basic needs of our life taken care of here, so we can let go and relax more deeply into our body. We're not having to figure a lot of things out, not solve a lot of problems. And so normally this is what happens to people on retreat. It might not be obvious the first day, but slowly as the retreat goes along, there's a letting go, a settling, a relaxing. Sometimes it's invisible because it happens so slowly until it's the last day, and some point we start talking, and it can seem overwhelming to talk. It's just so much. Wow, there's a lot of energy and activity and you realize that you are quieter and stiller than you had realized, had you guessed. And so, And that's part of the function of this retreat, is to help quiet things down for us, steady things. And one of the ways we cultivate this steadiness, this stability, is to keep coming back to the breath, to develop some modicum of concentration, to somehow retrain the mind, temporarily at least, to not always be focused on its distractions, on the thoughts and preoccupations and worries and concerns about the past and the future. And I think many of us have very strong habits to get involved in past, present, future, fantasy. And it's a habit which has been strengthened. And as I said this morning, what we're trying to do here is to weaken that habit and develop another habit and strengthen the capacity to stay present and focused in the moment, so that the mind can become quiet and stable and settled. And there's no magic formula for this happening. It's kind of like, there's like a button in the mind you push and say, well, now I'm going to be concentrated and one-pointed and stable. And I know that I have meditated with the unconscious assumption that there must be that thing. And so I was constantly judging myself for being a failure at meditation because I didn't find the button. And it took me a while to realize that it's a gradual process. Sometimes that process happens so gradually you don't see step by step as it functions, as it happens. But it definitely does happen as we go along. So I think I said this last night, but the analogy of this, of the pond, is very, very important for meditators. The muddy pond, if you'd like the pond to settle and have the water be clear, your best strategy is to leave the pond alone. But if you take a paddle or a stick or yourself and go into the pond and stir it up, it just keeps stirring up the mud, and so it's the mud stays agitated in solution. But if you leave it alone, it settles. So to a great degree, that's also true with our minds. And part of one of the things we're trying to do in meditation is to get out of the pond, get out of constantly stirring things up. And this means an interesting thing, that if you are bothered by your agitated mind, you're just stirring it up even more. So there's a kind of very meaningful way, which we try in retreat, not to be bothered by things, not to be bothered by the difficulties we feel in being being concentrated, being focused, being present, to take it all in stride. It's like this right now. It's okay. Let me just see it and hold it, make space for it. And part of the function of mindfulness, of awareness, is to make space for our things. I call it a breathing room, to make lots of space. It's okay. When there's space, things have a chance to settle. When we're claustrophobically kind of connected, involved with every little detail of our mind and our thoughts and our needs and what's happening, what's going to happen next, there's very little space for things to unwind and to settle. And it's very easy to get claustrophobic or get all tight up in the mind, kind of narrow, and everything is so meaningful, everything is so significant. And when every little thing and nuance of thing is meaningful, significant, and consequential, and has to be dealt with and judged and all kinds of, the mind stays spinning, it keeps the mud going. So part of the way to help the mind become stable and settle is to give a lot of room to it. It's okay. It's okay how you are. So just step back and give it time. Give your mind, give your heart time when you're here. And things will begin to unfold in a variety of ways. Things don't unfold on retreat in a linear fashion from worse to better. It would be nice if it that way. So one of the patterns that could happen over a retreat like this, and I'm not saying it's the pattern, your pattern might be a little different, but this is a pattern that I had in my first retreats. The first day on a 7-day retreat, I would feel so happy to be on retreat, so happy to be away from my busy ordinary life. And I was just kind of happy to be there. And because I was so agitated outside of life, just simply not talking and being quiet for a day, I calm down. And what I would do then was I would conclude that that was because of my great meditation powers. Look at me. It was just ordinary unwinding, you know. But I took credit for it. And then the next day, the tiredness that many people have the first day would catch up to me, and I'd be so tired and exhausted, and swaying back and forth and nodding off and trying so hard to, you know, fight the tiredness. And then, because now it wasn't working for me, again, I took so much credit for not making it, I'd feel really bad. I'm a terrible meditator. I should never have come here. What's going on here? And then, but then the tiredness would pass, and the third day would happen, and then I'd feel a little calmer, more focused. And I said, this is great. This is the best. Everyone should meditate. And I'd spend my half the day thinking about who I was going to tell. You know, you should come on retreat. It's so great. If you come on retreat, it'll help you not to think so much. And I wouldn't realize that I was thinking as I was telling myself these stories. And then the fourth day would come along, and whatever settling, unwinding that normally happened, kind of by that time it settled out. But I was still trying to push. I'm responsible. I'm the one who has to do this. And I'd be pushing and trying so hard to get concentrated, and pushing and trying hard. It's just, you know, you can dig your grave quickly that way. And I'd get a headache, and it would just be really hard. And then it's like, this, you know, again, what am I doing here? This is terrible. The teacher doesn't know what he's talking about. And all these other people on the retreat, they're all bumbling fools, and why am I ended up here? And then the fifth day would happen, and that would pass, and I'd finally give up. You know, sometimes I had to give up my attempt to try so hard. I give up. And only when I gave up would I start finally begin settling in and getting calm, and then things would go a little bit smoother. And so it would change over time, and there was a pattern, something like that for me. Some of it was painful to go through. And so a few things I learned in that process by doing a number of retreats. One of the things I learned was that as the retreat unfolds, there's different cycles. So we go through different things. Sometimes we're tired, sometimes we're not, sometimes our mind is concentrated, sometimes it's not. Sometimes it feels really great, sometimes it feels really lousy. And I learned that after enough retreats, that these are the cycles that happen on a retreat. And I learned to just recognize, oh, I'm at that point in the cycle. And I learned actually it was more wiser just to say, oh, this is where it is in the cycle, right on time. And then it'll change, I'm sure. And sure enough, it'll change. And what happened with that attitude was I became much more at ease, more relaxed about all the ups and downs I went through. And then the ups and downs weren't as big, especially the downs. And so there started to be a stability through all the various things that can happen in the retreat, a certain level of calm. And so that stability and calm, going through the ups and downs, became a ballast, became a support for me that made it a lot easier to go through it all. The stability supported me with the ups and downs. Yes, there's a lot of changes, and there can be a certain stability of calmness as we go through it. I learned not to assign so much meaning to everything. I was a big meaning maker. Everything that happened to me had tremendous meaning. It was consequential, you know. It meant my future of my well-being and happiness. But I learned, just leave it alone, Gil. You know, don't make meaning out of everything. Just let it be what it is. Be simple about it. This doesn't mean that I'm the greatest meditator. This doesn't mean I'm the worst meditator. This just means that my mind is distracted right now. Or this means that my mind is quiet right now. Just keep the constancy of the practice. Just keep the steadiness. Be steady in the practice. And I learned the value through all this of just being steady. Steady in the effort. Just keep going. Not pushing, not striving, not being like super gung-ho, but also not kind of giving up and kind of taking a lot of breaks, and just speak steady in an ordinary way. I think that on a 7-day retreat or any kind of retreat, it's helpful to think that the steadiness we hopefully have is one where we pace ourselves as we go through. If you start a marathon running as if you're going to do a 100-yard dash, you're not going to get very far. You don't start a marathon by giving it all the effort you have. The same thing on a retreat. You don't kind of sit down and just, you know, bear down. I'm going to be, you know, get into the, you know, the 10th jhana by 10 o'clock in the morning. You know, it just doesn't work that way to push. And there's a kind of pacing ourselves. And sometimes it's a lot better on retreat to do 60% of the effort that's available to you. You don't make 100% of the effort because then you just exhaust yourself. But maybe 60%. I don't know exactly what percentage should be. Who knows? Maybe it should be 10%. But something that you can hold steady. And something happens with a steady, something that you hold steady is that things begin organizing themselves around, things begin settling around it. It's kind of like when I was a kid in elementary school, some kids would come with magnets, these little red round, you know, U magnets that we used to have this when I was a kid. I probably still have them. And they would take it in the sandbox and they would run it in the same direction over and over again. And these little black pieces of iron ore, I guess it was, would line up and all line up in the same way. So the same thing, just steady kind of doing this practice, steady doing it, and things begin lining up. Things begin falling away. Things begin settling down. And some of the more dramatic ways in which there's the mind is inconstant. The mind swings up and down and forward and backwards, begins to even out or settle out. And there's more of a calmness or steadiness in the mind. So as the mind becomes more steady, more stable, then it's easier for the mind to see, to have insight into what's happening here in this world. A mind which is unstable is similar to having a camera, a movie camera, on a bouncy train. You know, you're holding in the train and you're trying to take a picture and so everything's kind of, you know, you know, shaking and you can't see very well. Or if you try to take a telescope, a small telescope, and hold in your hand to look at the star or the moon, you probably can't be stable enough to see anything. But if you put it on a tripod, that telescope, then you get enough stillness, stability, you can see the moon in the sky. So the same thing with the stability of the mind. When the mind becomes settled and quiet, then you can see more clearly. So that's part of the goal of this practice, is to create that stability. It's best not to be too responsible for creating it. It's more like you create the conditions that allow the mind to settle and become stable. Because when we take responsibility for it, then you might, you know, think you're the great meditator or the worst meditator. Just let it unfold. I love the expression from the movie, The Field of Dreams. Some of you have seen it. The kind of the refrain through the movie is, build it and they will come. Build it and he will come. And so some guy, he builds in the middle of some cornfield, he builds a baseball field, and you know, the movie unfolds, something happens because of that. But the idea of build it, then it'll come. So they have build your practice and let something happen. Build it and kind of get out of its way. So regularity of practice. It can help a lot to just show up for all the sittings. Do the sitting and the walking in a regular way. Unless you feel that it's counterproductive. There are times, maybe like first day, you're really tired, you need a nap. Or you feel like you're really being worn down by coming in here and maybe feeling back pain or something and you need to take a break. It's fine to do that. But the principle of regularity is so helpful. Don't take a break from the schedule and do something else because, you know, you're a bird watcher and you think, wow, there's nice birds here and this is my chance to really enjoy the birds. It's nice to enjoy birds, but that's not what you're here for. And so they kind of hold steady with the purpose that you're here. 60% effort, but just keep doing it. Keep coming. Keep showing up. Give yourself lots of room, lots of mental space for what's going on. It's not uncommon for Vipassana teachers to talk about the practice of acceptance. I like the idea of just allowance. Make lots of room. Some things shouldn't be accepted, but you can still make lots of room for them rather than be claustrophobic and caught and tight around it all. It's okay. Using the Great American Mantra, you know, America's great contribution to the vocabulary of mantras and the world of religion is the expression, it's okay. It was invented in Boston in the 1820s. And it's been one of America's great contributions to world culture. It's okay. And I believe that the American symbol for okay is to go like this, right? Put your fingers together and you're like, it's okay. You go like this, right? Don't you? Yeah, exactly. Like some people know, this is the symbol for it's okay. And if you do that with both hands and turn it upside down and put it on your hand, on your thighs, then you have the great, you know, it's okay gesture for meditation. And it's a powerful thing to say, it's okay. It's okay right now. It's okay. It helps create stability or steadiness, or kind of so we don't get so caught and swirl and reactive to what's going on. It helps a lot, if you can, to have a little sense of humor about how the mind behaves. If you take your mind personally, you're in trouble. But if you can kind of say, well, this mind, you know, to kind of step back a little bit and say, this mind has a mind of its own, and it's not doing all the things that I want it to do, but, you know, that's okay. And but it has some humor about it. There it is again. And look at it, you know, can you believe it? As opposed to, oh, no, this is terrible. Just, well, they say, there's a saying, if you can laugh at yourself, you'll never stop being humored. Isn't that great? So it helps. But if you can't be humored, at least be steady. Make space. It helps a lot to be very forgiving. Some people find it very meaningful to practice the practice of forgiveness. Forgiving yourself for your foibles, for how you are, for maybe how difficult you treat yourself, the hardness way. Forgive others. Not because we condone what other people do, but because when we don't forgive, we tend to stay agitated. Forgiving is giving up of our resentments, giving up of the harshness we have, so things can settle. There can be more space in the mind and more room in the mind to be here. It can help a lot to be compassionate. It's not easy to be a human being. It's not easy to do this practice. And so to be compassionate, caring, kind to yourself, to your fellow practitioners, have a compassionate attitude to what you're up against and what's going on here. Try to be kind to yourself, but not kind in a way where you think, well, you know, it's been a tough day and I've only had two baths today and they have these nice bathtubs here, so I think I'll go for two or more before the end of the day. How many baths can I do? You know who needs walking meditation? Bath meditation, that's really where it's at. I need to be kind and take care of myself. So you know, there's a way in which certain kind of kindness becomes a self-indulgence. Certain kind of kindness actually keeps the mind agitated, keeps the mind from settling. But a lot of kindness is helpful. Generosity of spirit, gracious to yourself for what goes on. As you keep the steadiness, as you just keep showing up, keep showing up. The mind wanders off, keep showing up, come back. Without a lot of expectation, a lot of demand, a lot of judgment about it, just come back. Hold it steady. So the idea of steadiness, of regularity, regular practice is very important. So like at home practice outside of retreat, there's something that something happens to the heart, the mind, when the heart knows that every morning you're going to get up and meditate, or every day you're going to meditate. There's a kind of a letting go that happens, a kind of acceptance of it happens, a kind of way in which the grooves or the habits get reinforced more and more deeply, and it helps support the development of inner strength. Without inner strength, it's hard to really do the take this practice the full way. And regularity of practice is part of the way we build strength, just like with exercise, regular exercise. If you only exercise once every 3 months, there's not much inner strength that gets developed. So I think of regularity as part of the stability factor of that we're trying to cultivate. Steadiness, regularity, stability, calm, focus. What is not stable is being fixated. Fixation makes us more vulnerable, more fragile. So to hold yourself, to hold on to the practice really tightly, to hold on to some idea, hold on to some self-concept, hold on to a resentment, hold on to a fear, which, you know, it's easy to do. Paradoxically, that kind of fixation on things, grasping things, makes us much more vulnerable. The stability, the steadiness that we're cultivating in meditation is hopefully one that's soft, pliant, resilient. So how to become soft? So if you find yourself as you meditate trying really in a hard, forceful way to get concentrated, chances are you're actually making the mind more brittle, more vulnerable. And what we're trying to do is come back and help the mind become focused, steady, but soft at the same time. And that's part of the art of it all. And a lot of it has to do with just coming back. Coming back, as you come back to the breath, come back to the present moment, and then try to stay there with it. Try to get interested in it. Try to be more fully engaged or involved or intimate with this experience right here. Making lots of space, room in the mind for your experience, and then also to kind of be intimate with the experience, be caring about it, be caring of what your own experience is, so you stay present, be interested here, regardless of what it is. I think part of things like regularity, stability, steadiness, both internally as we practice, but also externally in a place like this, is so that we can start feeling safe. Because it's a lot easier for the heart, the mind to steady, to relax, to settle down when we feel safe. And it's my hope and in my efforts, that of everyone who's helped create IRC, is to try to make this a culture and a place where you all will feel safe. And I know that the feeling of safety is not one that's easy to come by or easy to feel, and when we have maybe a lifetime of not feeling safe. But the hope is that this feels like a safe place to come, a safe community to be within, and so that something in our hearts can settle, can feel okay, can relax. We can lower our guard, stop bracing ourselves, stop needing to be perfect, stop needing to be a perfect way or a certain way. It's okay for you to be yourself here. So I know that the first day of a retreat can be challenging and challenging for your body. So sometimes sitting this way. People normally don't sit and meditate so many hours a day. So knees, backs, different parts of the body can, you know, can get tired and sore, and different things happen. I know that that the mind can be challenging. All the different things that we carry in our minds and our life with us, and it can be difficult to settle down, or sometimes difficult to kind of face what the mind throws up. It can be a challenge to be in a new environment. Some people have trouble sleeping in a new bed, and so there's that issue. Sometimes the new food is challenging. Being around strangers can be challenging. I know that all these things are challenging. So I mention that so that if you feel challenged by it, that that you'll understand that it's you're right on time. That's okay. That's kind of what happens. And but hang in there. You have a lot of days here. Things will unfold. Things will unwind. Things will settle out. It's remarkable how quickly things change. In comparison to how many years you have let your distracted mind be distracted, have free rein and do whatever it wants. You've trained your mind to kind of be caught up in thoughts and ideas and feelings and all this. It's really remarkable how quickly you can undo it, all that. Though conventionally it looks like it'll take a while. But if you hold it up on a scale, the number of years you've been distracted and how long it takes to settle down, it goes pretty fast, even though it's incremental. So give it a chance. Give yourself over. Trust the process that's here. And see if you can take these, what I had to say today about stability and steadiness, regularity, constancy, and to use that as a reference point for how to be practice here in a way that supports you and helps you, allows you to relax, unwind, settle, let go of things, and let the heart, not just the mind, but let the heart drop a notch or two into the chest. Settle down. Open up. Feel at ease. Good hearts of yours, may it be at ease. May it discover greater and greater ease as you sit here. Okay, so it's often a custom on these retreats to end the talk by returning into the meditation posture, taking maybe a minute or so, as a way of regathering oneself, kind of intentionally and clearly, allowing oneself to return to that mode of practice we had the rest of the day. There's a way in which being clear and intentional about what you're doing that can help steady the mind, settle the mind. So now, in a relaxed, clear, intentional way, settle into your body. Reestablish your mindfulness. With the intention to be present. Present with the breath. Present with your body, present to the present moment.
So for how many of you is this your first residential retreat? Great. How are you doing?
Okay. Terrible. I am. I feel as though I'm coming down with something. I'm just spent, aching.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think I can make it through dinner. So, I mean, is this normal? Is that unique? Or is it a combination? Maybe I am coming down with something, but it's also part of this.
You might be coming down with something, but it's very common for the first retreat. Especially in the beginning of the first retreat. You're doing a lot of things that the body isn't used to doing. I mean, you sit in your regular life, you know, in different places or whatever, but not this continual, you know, it's a physical practice. So there's one thing. And the second thing is that usually we're so busy and distracted that we don't really notice a condition or how we're feeling in the same way as on retreat. Things may start to physically intensify and it feels like, oh, this is making it feel this way. But actually it's just your awareness is growing. It's not that of what's been... So my suggestion is to take really good care of yourself. You know, keep trying to do the schedule as much as you can, but if you need to take a nap, if you need to take a break, you know, that's fine. And just as Gil was saying, things change really fast on retreat. So you could, even between one sitting and the next sitting, you may have noticed that one sitting feels one way. You get up, you walk, and then you come back and sit. And it's like, oh, maybe it feels worse, but it's changed. And so tomorrow will be different.
I would say like opposite, everything just seems fantastic, you know. It's like you guys made us just like kind of a welcoming, comfortable place to be, and I really appreciate that there's a whole lot less decisions to make in everyday life.
Right.
And sense of just being, you know, welcomed here is really a nice feeling. And I had one sit that I was very sleepy, and I kept thinking I should stand up, but feeling sleepy feels good. For the most part, I've just felt very peaceful and calm and very glad to be here.
So great. Great. And you know, and just so you know, that may change as well, which is okay. It's like, it's almost like, you know, after you've done a number of retreats, there can be this sense of, as kind of Gil was saying, this evenness. So one day it's one way, one day it's another way, one sitting it's one way, one sitting it's another way. And it's like, how freely can we move through these, you know, without getting caught? You know, this is the real, it's always going to be this way, or, you know, something. And it's just like, you know, it's just change. And what we're doing is we're refining our perception of change. You know, we're seeing change. So it's great. I'm happy for you. And that's, you know, may it continue.
Feeling welcomed and taken care of, that's a given. That's, yeah.
You feel, yeah.
What about, so exhausting, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel tired too, yeah. I'm somewhere in between those two. Huh. So I think that it was really nice to hear Gil say last night that this exhaustion is something that can happen.
The swamp mind. Yeah,
yeah,
it's
so
really common.
It's very nice to hear that these things are regularly experienced by others. And it was very, I think this first Dharma talk was really also setting the sort of with the space, so that everything that happens is okay.
Right, right.
And with my exhaustion, there really is, like a sort of resettling of things that are going on in my life and everything. And really, it's tiring to spend that much time with attention to myself, and to the present moment.
Great. Mm-hmm. It's having the attitude that everything is okay. It's supposed to happen. It's it can be a very helpful way of framing the experience, of looking at the experience, because who knows? Mm-hmm. This is, that exhaustion may be some message, mm-hmm. That I don't know what your was going on for you, before you came here, but it's like, for some people, it's like a driving 90 miles per hour and then screeching to a stop, and there's this there's this momentum, and there's this, all this stuff was happening all this time that I was just behind the wheel, and it kind of catches up, and then it resettles, and then it's like, it will sync up, and
I'm just wondering when I'll get past 8 breaths before my mind engages.
Never.
I really like the analogy of like training a puppy, and it's like the puppy's going. If you have a leash and the puppy's going in this way, then you kind of gently, and the puppy goes. And it takes a while before the puppy doesn't need the leash anymore, and it just kind of stays. And
sometimes I feel, like I'm getting there, and then, I have no control. All these things just start happening, and then I take myself back.
And what do you do when you notice that, you've lost control, or all this stuff is happening?
Sometimes there's so much, but I hardly notice it.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I notice, oh yes.
You kind of stuff.
And then I go back to trying to very carefully breathe and to, try to almost bring down a halo over my body, so I'm feeling, I start focusing on how everything's feeling.
Yeah, great.
But then, there's X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. But that you notice that is great. And that you notice that means the practice is working. It's like, it's not like being mindful of the breath is like the first class mindfulness, and then, but noticing that you've been lost in a daydream, that's okay, but that's, just get back to the breath quickly. It's like, it doesn't matter what you're aware of. It's like, and being with the breath is great, but every time you notice that you're off the breath means the practice is working. It means that that's a moment of mindfulness. You have to be mindful, otherwise you would just be off continuously for 40 minutes, 45 minutes. So that you notice, I'm off. You can have a little inner smile and just gently come back. And every time you come back, it may feel like it's this slog, but you're strengthening that muscle of mindfulness. And before long, you'll feel the results of it. But just to keep, it could be 1,000 times, just come back. Just notice it and come back. And with as much as you can, without, self-judgment, without evaluating it against some idea of what's supposed to happen. Because, as Gil was saying, that's not helpful. But it sounds great. I mean, that's just exactly the experience that, it means the practice is working. And
I'm wondering if the these two things are correlated, like the constantly going away and then also the exhaustion. It's kind of like the monkey is really exhausted.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
The monkey mind is very tired.
And it's almost like to be mindful itself doesn't take effort. You know, it's like if you ring the bell, it doesn't take effort to hear it. It's effortless. You just hear it. It's not, you know, like, no, it just comes in. But what takes the effort is to remember to do it and to kind of, so it's like, if you notice that tension, you know, if you feel like you're fighting with yourself, it's like, is there a way to, you know, be more gentle, or, you know, those moments of remembering, of mindfulness, you know, just letting it not be a conflict or something. Just, it's like, oh, okay, you come back. And then, because actually more tension, it won't help you stay present more. It actually just, my experience, it just gets you more, it's just more tense, you know. But yeah, it can be exhausting when you're, yeah.
And, you know, but I think that's probably connected to my mind too, because now that I'm sitting here at the end of the day, I'm not feeling discomfort.
Right.
So I'm, like, maybe I'm also not focusing on, but I was worried about was that it seemed to get cumulatively worse each time I sat down. At first it was better.
Yeah.
But it was harder to sit for the 40th minute by the...
Sure. Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's, I think I can say with confidence that the final sitting of the final day won't be that many times more, you know, exponentially 10,000 times harder.
Can you talk about the point of sitting upon awakening? I can't understand that.
How is sitting...
You know, early morning.
Oh, you mean in first at the beginning? Yeah.
Yeah, what's the thinking?
Well,
could you repeat the question?
Sure. So the question is, why do we sit immediately when we wake up in the morning? Is that the question,
or was it
the purpose? So, you know, so a few things like when everyday practice at home. You know, some people like to sit in the morning, some people like to sit in the evening. And since we're here, we're sitting all day, so we start in the morning. There is this idea that kinds of deep meditation have some similarity to kinds of deep sleep with the brain. And it's almost like when you wake up in the morning, there can be this like liminal space, and that's, you know, sometimes it's easier to remember. I mean, it's almost always easier to remember dreams right after you wake up. And so you're kind of in this in-between space, and it's like we haven't so much put ourself together, you know, identity, our relational self. So there's still this kind of, you know... So some people think that, and then also sitting late at night, it also when you're tired, you know, this is saying like when you're tired, your ego is tired, and you can kind of drop some of those ego defenses, drop some of those habitual ways of defining ourselves, and so in Zen, especially night sitting is encouraged. You know, it's like after the program, sometimes people will sit in the meditation hall late into the night. And, you know, you might be between, you know, am I sleeping? Am I sitting? You know, the other thing I would say is on long retreats and in deep meditation, there can be times when you don't really need much as much sleep as you usually would. So I would say in my regular life, it's nice for me to have 7 or 8 hours. I don't always get it with the baby, but 7 or 8 hours, it would be very nice. But on a retreat, on a long retreat, my eyes may open after three or four hours, and I feel very refreshed. And one of the things I realized is that what tends to exhaust me is a lot of thinking. And that's a lot of mental energy, to thinking, into worrying, into whatever I do, usually. So when that gets relaxed on retreat, then the need for sleep is reduced and all these things. So then the instruction is, if you just wake up, or if this could happen on retreat here, you might wake up and you think, oh, it's too early. But if you feel awake, if you feel bright and refreshed, then you can go ahead and sit. You know, sit in your room, sit on your bed. You know, you may get tired in 10 minutes and go back to sleep, or you may sit, you know, but not to feel like, and then if you could wake up and feel bright and then sit for an hour and then come in and start the day, and then you may get tired and then take a nap or something. So don't feel like, you know, you have to kind of rigidly keep the schedule, because something is happening. And that's another thing. It's like, you know, the more mental proliferation and thinking, it's a big source of exhaustion. So, yeah.
I was going to ask, maybe if you were going outside to do a walk,
yeah,
would it be helpful to keep your surroundings somewhat simple versus going through like the kind of brush and all the trees and everything?
Oh, I see. I think so. I think there's something about, it's like, you know, the movement on retreat is towards simplification and towards progressively more and more simple. And like, you know, there becomes a point in the meditation when it's so simple, it's like there's nothing you can even do. Even mindfulness is a kind of a doing. So anything that you think that can support that can be very helpful. Like I know someone who only starts to drink, this is after a while into retreat, she'll only drink hot water. Because choosing a tea becomes so much work. You know, she simplified so much, and then it's like, you know, she just doesn't want to deal with it. And so, you know, it's just an example. And so, yeah, if you feel that, if there's something about that that you kind of intuitively feel keeping it simple when you walk is really nice to do. And then there can be a time when it's like you might feel, maybe towards the middle of the retreat, maybe you start to feel a little claustrophobic or a little, what is it called, stir?
Cabin fever.
Then, you know, then it can be helpful to go outside and like look up at the trees and look at, you know, and then, you know, or go out to the road a little bit and just, you know, something like that, so...
Speaking of stir crazy, there's that whole dimension too, that you basically, you know, you're like letting go of your, or trying to let go of your thinking, but then you kind of can drive yourself crazy, you know, like, oh, I'm thinking the same things, and I'm trying to come back, you know, it's like, but I'm not talking to anybody, so you don't have your usual sense of equilibrium.
Yeah.
You know, you kind of can feel like you're losing your bearings.
Oh yeah, and it's like if sometimes I think like if I talk to another person the way I talk to myself, and you know how repetitive I talk to myself, you know, they would think I'm crazy, you know. And so it's like we can drive ourselves crazy, and we do, and you know. So one thing that can be very helpful is to. It's like the process here is towards disentangling and disidentifying with thoughts, with thinking. Usually we believe them. We believe the content of our thoughts, especially when it's thinking about ourselves. Well, it must be true. I thought it, you know, I must have to do that, you know, right away. I had a few ideas for the talk I'm going to give, and I thought, oh, I have to remember that. And then I thought, have to write that down. It's like, you know, and so one thing that can be helpful is just to put a little note, a little label, you know, when there's thinking, it's just, you know, thinking. And it creates a little bit of distance, and it gives the thinking mind something to do. So instead of being in the thought, it's like you've shifted to the process. It's like, oh, thinking. Or sometimes it can be helpful is to repeat back the thought, especially if it's absurd. Like, have to write down these thoughts about my Dharma talk or else the world will end. You know, what does it feel like? You know, and it's like, okay, that's probably not true. But yeah, and then also just having, you know, just kindness, compassion. It's like, just think, all this is still going on when we're not on retreat, but it's just controlling us and we're not aware of it. It's just operating, you know, in the background. So now we see it, and it can be painful to see it, but only through seeing it can we actually have some freedom from it, you know, and some control. So it's like, it's almost like the pain of, it's painful, but it's better to know, in a way. It's better to know and then, you know, be able to work with it and be able to, you know, ignorance is bliss, but until, you know, we have the consequences of it. Does that feel like enough? Is it?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.